When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, Psychoactive listeners. So today, our guest is Boris Jordan. He is the founder and a major shareholder in the company Curaleaf, which I think is either the biggest or one of the biggest cannabis companies in the world, right? It's a major multi-state operator. He also has a hedge fund called Measure 8. And just to get a sense how big it is, he's got almost 6,000 people working for him now. He's got 137 dispensaries, last I looked, in 21 states. He's got over 24 cultivation sites. I mean, this is a major operation. Its valuation is in the billions of dollars on the stock exchange. He's a major player in cannabis industry circles and also deeply involved in the politics of all of this. And he's got a fascinating life even before he got into cannabis. So, Boris, thank you ever so much for joining me on Psychoactive.
I am super excited to be here. Thank you, Ethan.
Okay. Well, listen, Boris. So look, let's just jump in. We do need to talk a bit about what's going on in Congress right now. So this Safe Banking Act, right? You know, allowing more people in the industry and businesses to get access to safe banks and the whole discussion about can or should this go through, you know, without there being all sorts of racial equity, racial justice provisions that would both include expungement, that would also include, ensuring a better level of access or some preferential access for minority business owners. You know, can this happen? I mean, Schumer, you know, on the show and since then has said, I don't want, you know, any safe banking going through unless it's got some racial equity provisions. And Cory Booker from New Jersey has been even stronger on that. So what is the state of play from where you sit?
Well, Ethan, it's not a simple, piece of legislation. I'm sure you more than anybody knows that. It's been, 50 some odd years of repression on the sector. And we've come to a situation now where, I actually believe we're closer than we've ever have been for of potentially getting a piece of federal legislation that at a minimum recognizes the existence of cannabis as a substance that can be consumed in various forms by the population at large. So the short of it is, I think we have a piece of legislation that's being worked on now that has obviously the safe banking component. And the safe banking component means that cannabis companies would have access to basic banking for their businesses. And I think it will also have a safe harbor provision that would allow investors to invest in the sector. And I think it will also have some level of what we call plus level, you know, HOPE Act issues like expungement and potentially, and I think this is the issue that Booker wants the most, and that is some level of money to help these states with closing these expungements. Because the one thing is you can come out and say, okay, we have, you know, we've expunged these felonies or these misdemeanors, but another thing is to actually get it off the actual physical record, and that takes money and time. Obviously, there's a lot of different advocacy groups that want whatever it is that they want in this piece of legislation. We could probably spend 2 hours talking about all the different things people want in this piece of legislation. The way I look at this, and I think that's where we're heading, is that this is the first step in what will be a multi-year, potentially multi-generational move towards legalization of not only cannabis, but other drugs as well. And I think that we have to see it that way, and we have to put our, I wouldn't say differences, because to be honest, I'm on the same page as a lot of the other people are in terms of all the things we'd like to get in this legislation, particularly on some of the racial social equity issues. But I think that what we need to do is get something that we think can get passed so that we could, you know, break the glass ceiling, say, and actually get a piece of legislation on the books that then, you know, we'll use every year to expand on, liberalize. And for the most part, that's what happened in the states as well. A lot of the states initially passed very restrictive legislation, and then eventually they liberalized that legislation as the sort of the demons of cannabis came down and people realized it wasn't as bad as everybody thought it was. They started to liberalize. And I think that's where we are now.
And so I see the activists saying, you know, what we should have in there is providing Small Business Administration loans to new legal cannabis businesses trying to get started, or making sure that banks provide support for new minority-owned enterprises. And I say, the problem has typically been, you know, the Republicans on this thing, right? I mean, the Democrats, you know, all for safe banking. They love it. They even passed it as standalones before. The Republicans are generally for standalone. The Democrats are saying, put some of this other stuff in. And the Republicans keep, you know, nah, we don't like that racial equity stuff. Get rid of it. But are the Republicans going to move along on this stuff and drop their opposition to, you know, we don't like this racial equity stuff. We'll do expungement, but forget all that other preferential stuff?
Listen, I think where we are right now is that we have, if it was purely safe, we have about 80 votes in the Senate. As you know, we need 60 votes to get this through. So the real issue is, once you start adding Veterans Affairs, small business loans, racial equity, expungements, and all these things, you start to lose votes. And frankly, not only Republican votes, but there are several Democrats that you lose votes on as well. The ones that typically cause a problem for Democrats and a lot of the legislation that they've been trying to pass. So what we've been trying to do is get Schumer and Booker to give us a final draft, per se, draft. We understand it'll get negotiated, that we could go and cross to the other side and start talking to the Republicans about what they're prepared to accept and not prepared to accept. The problem is, every time you add anything, you lose a couple of them, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the problem is.
What happens if the Republicans take not just the House, which everybody expects, but they also take the Senate? Are things then dead because McConnell just doesn't want it? Or when you say there's 80 votes for a straight safe banking, that supplies that there's 30 Republicans out of the 49 or 50 who would be in favor of it. So is it conceivable that a straight out safe banking goes through next year if Republicans have both houses? Or are the Democrats going to mobilize against it so much it won't happen on that end?
McConnell's the problem in this situation. So there are votes on the Republican side, but only under democratically controlled House, because McConnell doesn't want to have on his record legalization of any kind in cannabis.
But safe banking is not legalization. And if you're saying he's got, you know, 30 out of 50 Republicans already saying they want it, I mean, you know, what's the problem there? I mean, he did move around on hemp, maybe because of Rand Paul's influence and being in Kentucky some years ago. But safe banking is not real. I mean.
So he regrets ever passing the hemp bill. He thought it was, you know, hemp for rope. He didn't think it was hemp for weed. And what's happened is, you know, he did not think that what's happening now countrywide with Delta 8 and Delta 9, two THC components that are being derived from hemp, and these products are spreading nationally. He's adamantly against that. And so he is very negative on anything to do with either CBD, hemp, or cannabis at this stage. Listen, I can't get into the guy's head, but I can tell you what he said. We are not going to put either into committee or on the floor vote with anything to do with cannabis at the Senate if he controls the Senate.
Okay, Boris, let me just embarrass you just a little bit here, right? So I should tell our listeners, full disclosure, that, you know, after I stepped down from running Drug Policy Alliance 5 years ago, I thought about getting involved in the industry in some way, and it just felt unseemly to make a switch from advocacy into that. But last year, I said, what the hell? And I decided to make a significant investment for me in the hedge fund that Boris had set up called Measure 8. And like an idiot, I did it at the peak of the market last spring, a year and a half ago. I, if anybody, should have known better than that. And so my investment is now down 60% in your hedge fund, Boris, although I understand it would probably be down even more if I had invested in some of the other funds. But that being said, so I'd go on a couple of your quarterly calls, and I remember like a year or so ago, you were really optimistic. I'm talking to people, people don't appreciate. So I'm taking what you say and your optimism with a grain of salt, but why do you think you got it pretty wrong last year?
Well, because I was speaking to, you know, the powers that be. I had calls with Schumer and others, and you know, they were very optimistic they were going to get this done, and they misled, to be honest, a lot of us. And you know, we love to blame the Republicans, Ethan, on anything to do with cannabis or, you know, liberalization of drug policy. But the fact is, the Democrats have had a Democratic president and two houses that are controlled by Democrats, and they have done zero on this issue. And so, you know, today, obviously, I'm positive because I can see the activity, but you know, I'm a person that tries to believe what I'm told.
Yeah.
And I was told by the higher ups in the party that they were going to get this done, and they didn't.
All right. Boris, you know, this is my little suggestion. Give the Democrats a little more love before you hit them on that stuff. Because I'm watching your interviews and you're slamming, you know, Schumer and Booker, they're screwing it up. They should have had this done before. And then you're saying in the states, the Democrat-led governments in the states, they won't crack down on the illicit markets because Biden bailed them all out with the big federal funding. And once they don't run out of money, they're going to have to crack down then. They'll see. But meanwhile, the fact of the matter is, of course, it's Democrats, with a few major exceptions, who have really driven this thing nationally, right? It's Democratic states, which basically are the places mostly where you're doing really good business. It's Democratic leadership in Congress that led this thing. You know, it's Democratic voters who disproportionately voted in favor of this thing. So I can agree with you to some extent about Schumer and Booker and how slow they've been on getting their shit together. But on the other hand, you know, but for the Democrats, if the Republicans were running things, you know, Curaleaf, your business, the whole industry wouldn't be much of anywhere. And meanwhile, the Democrats, they got, what, 5 or 10 seat margin in the House? They got 0 seat margin in the Senate. It's not like FDR and the New Deal. So getting anything through. So anyway, my suggestion, give a little more love before you kind of smack them around.
Ethan, I spend more money and more love on the Democrats than on any party in Washington. And so I can tell you this. I don't give very little credit to the federal government and Congress or the presidency. Both Republicans and Democrats on these policies, I give them zero. I do, however, give a high grade to our various governors and local governments that have been really brave in pushing these policies. But at the federal government, which is what you and I are talking about now, I give them an F.
So just a few other issues, and I'll wrap up this current conversation. 280E, about allowing businesses, marijuana businesses, take a tax deduction. That going to happen anytime soon, or is that still years away?
So they're trying to actually put that into this current law that they're trying to get passed in the lame duck.
Uh-huh.
Now, my concern with that, Ethan, is that that's a Trojan horse. I worked on the Ways and Means Committee in 1986 when we were doing tax reform, kind of showing my age. But anyway, I can tell you that to change tax policy in the United States is very complicated. You have to score the tax. You have to find an alternative for that tax, for the revenue from that. I don't believe personally that we can get that done between now and the lame duck. Mm-hmm. And so my concern is that if they put that into the law, it's dead on arrival, even though the Republicans tend to be pro tax reduction. Although I'd like to see what their position would be on cannabis tax reduction, but they tend to be pro tax reduction. So,
and would you say the same thing also about there's this CLIMB Act, CLIMB, that would basically, you know, provide a safe harbor so that, you know, companies like yours could be listed on U.S. stock exchanges or at least be able to access Wall Street funding? Same issue where it's going to be some years down the road and don't get things distracted now? Because I hear the activists are very worried about it. They see, you know, opening up the funding for, you know, you guys to Wall Street just, you know, enhances consolidation of this whole industry. You know, your valuations will, you know, go through the ceiling, but the whole consolidation process, which activists and some others are really trying to slow down to keep some elements of this industry as small business, that'll go by the wayside.
Well, I actually have a completely the opposite view. If they don't get rid of 280E, and if they don't allow eventual uplisting, I'm not the one that's going to suffer, right? It's going to be the small entrepreneurs that are going to suffer because there's no cheap funding for them.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with those companies now is that they're having to pay, you know, usury rates to start the company, kind of the way I had to, right? When I started this business 10 years ago, you know, we were paying, you know, 15, 20% for our money to try to start the business. Now, the fact is we had an open playing field, so it was much less competitive. Now the market's much more competitive. Pricing is being squeezed, so the profitability levels are way down. You're paying basically a 75% tax rate on that. And so the small companies cannot survive. I want to reiterate this. Without 280E, without safe banking, and without uplisting, the small business owner is finished in cannabis. So if we don't get this in the lame duck session, over the next 2 years, the five major companies in the U.S. will consolidate the whole industry underneath them because nobody else is going to be able to get funding.
Aren't the states kind of limiting how many, you know, dispensaries you guys can own in any one place?
Yeah, but they're not going to be able to, they're not going to be able to keep doing anything because I'm telling you right now, we have something called three tiers of cannabis companies in the U.S. The top tier is the top five companies. Then there's about 10 companies in what we call tier two. And then everybody else is in tier three. And then there's the private companies that are tier four. Everything below tier two is going to start going bankrupt because they can't refinance and there's no money available. Why would investors put money in the sector where there's no liquidity and they can't realize their upside? So what's going to happen is the big companies will always be able to attract investment, although it'll be more expensive. The medium and small companies are going to attract no investment. So what is going to happen? They're going to start going bankrupt and shutting their doors. So what's going to happen? We're going to go to the states, to the regulators and say, guys, here's your alternative. Either these companies shut down and we lose all those jobs, or you allow us to come in and consolidate them and at least save the jobs in the business. So, you know, the states are going to have to make a decision. Do they want to, you know, have this sector continue to expand, or are they going to want to shut it down? And if they decide to shut it down, they shut it down. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. They're going to want the tax revenue, so they're going to want these businesses to keep going. And so they're going to allow consolidation to take place in these states. They're going to have to. It's inevitable.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have
have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Let me ask you about a particular state, Oklahoma, right? I mean, it looks like the total Wild West. Basically, it looks like they're giving out licenses like candy there. And the result is that you have, I don't know, massive numbers of dispensaries and outlets, you know, medical marijuana, but, you know, basically anybody can get it. But what somebody was telling me recently is that one upside of that is that in basically every little city and town in Oklahoma, you have some local business people who set up their own little operation. And if you go to a black town, it's going to be a black-owned dispensary. In a white town, this. And the question is, what do you think about that model? Or is it inevitable that there'll be consolidation in Oklahoma as well?
They won't be able to survive. Mm-hmm. They'll all have to consolidate because there's too many of them. We saw this in Oregon. We saw this in California. Mm-hmm. There's too many of them. There used to be 2,800 dispensaries in California. There's less than 800 now. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is they all go out of business. Mm-hmm. Capitalism's capitalism, Ethan, right? You know, you have to make a great product. You have to invest in that product. You have to build your distribution. To do these things, you need a lot of money. This is not a capital light industry. This is a capital heavy industry. Yeah. In other words, you have to invest a lot to get a result. And people want a return on that investment. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen this for 200 years in the United States, right?
Yeah.
Lots of small brewers, lots of small alcohol companies, cigarette companies, other things. They eventually all merged into these large conglomerates because of the nature of the way the system is built.
I know, Boris. I mean, I'll be frank with you and our listeners here. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you know, I'm a kind of small is beautiful kind of guy, you know, ideologically. You know, I've been on record as saying I'm not in this whole thing, the fight for the Marlboroization or Budweiserization of marijuana. I do think there's a moral obligation to try to get racial equity provisions and to make them work. But the other part of me knows we live in, you know, perhaps the most dynamic capitalist society in history. I look at when I moved to New York City 30 years ago, and there were all sorts of different little, you know, coffee shops out. Then Starbucks come along and they all get wiped out. But now I walk around New York City and I see more small ownership, a single store, a few of the three or four stores, and there's been a proliferation. And so the non-Starbucks niche seems to be slowly growing and growing, not unlike what's happened with microbreweries in the beer area, not unlike what's happened with, you know, the micro distilleries. And you see it's still under 10%, but it's growing quite dramatically in many places. And I wonder, you know, when all is said and done, is that going to be the inevitable future of the broader cannabis industry?
I agree with you, actually. And I'll tell you what it is. What happens is the big companies get lazy. They start to manufacture a product which is not, you know, interesting. They don't innovate. And the consumer is always looking for the next great thing, right, Ethan? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can get a cup of coffee from a local brewer of coffee that's much nicer than a Starbucks coffee, I'll even pay up for that to get that cup of coffee. And I think that that's what we're seeing. And we're not only seeing that in the U.S., particularly in the coffee industry, we're seeing that across the whole world. If you go to the U.K., you got, you know, Cafe Nero, you got a whole bunch of these different companies that are coming up and are starting to challenge the monopolies of, you know, the Starbucks of the world. And I encourage that. I always say to my people at Curaleaf, there's some kid sitting in a garage, sorry for the cliche, but that's, you know, in a garage, thinking of a way to disrupt what we're doing, just like we disrupted Curaleaf, how the industry looked, you know, 8 years ago.
Right.
And so there's always somebody else. And that's the beauty of the American system. I believe in the American capitalist system. It's not perfect. We have a lot of problems and we have a lot of problems to fix. But what I'm not a believer in is socialism, and I never have been. And someone whose family ran from communism, and someone who saw what was going on in Russia in the early 1990s when I went over there as a young man to, you know, put up my footprint, my imprint on that economy, I can tell you socialism doesn't work anywhere in the world.
Boris, you put on the table, Boris Jordan is one fascinating guy. He was born, you know, in Long Island. He's in his mid-50s now. His parents, grandparents had fled from, you know, during the Russian Revolution in 19, you know, around 1917 or so. His grandfather, I think, was involved in part of, you know, at a higher levels in the Tsarist government. You know, he's what you would call a white Russian. And he grows up in Long Island in a little white Russian community in Sea Cliff. And he's really, I think, still, you're very much woven into that. And then in the 1990s, when you're going to business school, you know, you see all the, you know, the sons of the elites, you know, going to, from Latin America, going back and setting up American banking. And you, speaking Russian, growing up that way, go back to Russia, become the boy wonder of Russia markets, you know, with funds and helping get the Russian stock market going. You take over a TV station, NTV. That goes on for a few years. You're reportedly friendly with Putin in those days, and then you piss him off in 04, and life changes. So I want to ask you in the first question here, you know, you were involved in Russia deeply in the 90s, the Boris Yeltsin years, the Wild West years, and then you come to cannabis. But what I want to know is, you know, when was it that you first thought about getting into the cannabis industry? Where were you in your life? You know, what made you think about this?
I'd love to be able to say that I was an early advocate as you are, but that would be a lie. You know, I stumbled into cannabis. So, you know, obviously as a college and high school student, I smoked weed like everybody else and enjoyed it. But then I stopped doing it in my mid-20s and into my 30s after having children and stuff like that. Not because I was against it, but I just stopped. I took on other things. And then, you know, I tend to start businesses in those countries where I live. So when I was in Russia, I had a whole series of different companies. Then I moved to the UK and I started, you know, what became the largest data center operation in Europe, a company called Telecity. Mm-hmm. We lived there for 11 years. And then I moved back to the United States and I had a friend of mine come over, a very interesting person. He came to me and he said, "Hey, I'm starting a cannabis medical device business." He came up with a patent for a machine that was going to deliver specific dosage of cannabis to late-stage cancer patients in hospitals, and he wanted to get that approved by the FDA. Well, mm-hmm. I invested in his business, and obviously the FDA wasn't going to look at this, and then I kept telling him and his colleagues that they have to pivot to this vertical business because I started looking into cannabis, and then I reoriented the company from the medical device business to this vertical cannabis cultivation, manufacturing, and distribution.
So it goes from being a kind of little sideline interest in 2014, where it absorbs more and more and more of your time, to the point of today, where it's 80 or 90% of how you spend your time in business.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm almost full time, to be honest. I'm spending most of my time on cannabis now. You're right.
And yeah. Okay.
I'm super fascinated with it.
So, Boris, I got to bring up when Putin invaded Ukraine some months ago, you know, you took a lot of flack because you put out this kind of lukewarm thing, a kind of both sides, hope there can be peace resolution. Clearly, you were not, you know, in no public place condemning, you know, this brutal assault on Ukraine by Putin. And you knew the guy 20 years ago. And I'm just assuming the reason you haven't said anything more boldly is that, you know, Putin kills people. And he's vicious, and you still have friends and business interests in Russia. And so your view was, you know what? The cost of my saying something criticizing Putin on this invasion is going to be risky in various ways. It's just I'd rather take the shit from the community for not being bolder. Was that basically what happened?
No, I'm going to tell you. I'm an old-line student of business, and I know things have changed, Ethan, and mm-hmm. maybe I need to change. But everything I learned about business, not only from my father, but also in school and in my first jobs, is that business and politics are separate. And I have made it a 30-year issue that I do not get involved in politics while I'm running businesses. And I'll tell you, one of my mentors, George Soros, mm-hmm. pushed that with me until, of course, he switched his fund to philanthropy and to a charity, and then he got involved heavily into politics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you know the old George, which I do, and if you read his book, Soros on Soros, he's got three pages about our relationship in there. Mm-hmm. You'll know that he was one of the people that said, Boris, focus on the business and stay out of politics. And so I try to stay out of the politics because I don't believe there's any upside to business in getting involved in politics.
Well, listen, let's turn to a few other things here. On the future of the industry, I mean, I've heard you say, look, so many people focus on what happened last quarter or not. You focus on the fundamentals. You think like Warren Buffett. You think like BlackRock. This is long term. You're in it for long term. One of the things you've been saying about the nature of this industry, apart from the stuff we've been talking about, is you think 50% of the industry will be people drinking their cannabis within a few years. And so tell me what you see on the evolution of this thing in terms of the drinkables, the edibles, other forms of consuming. How do you see this thing evolving and why?
So, Ethan, I think the industry is going to break up into three categories. There's going to be the pharmaceutical part of the industry, and that's when synthetic cannabinoids come about. I believe this pharmaceutical companies will switch from being the biggest opponents mm-hmm. of legalization to the biggest proponents of legalization. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that's not an area where we intend to play. That's going to be really a pharma category. And by the way, I think the cannabis plant is such a great medical plant that I think that they're going to do very well in that area. The second part of the industry is going to be what I call the nutraceutical part or the wellness part. And that is somewhere where we do want to play. We just launched a rub, which is really revolutionary. I'm recommending it to everybody. It's a rub for arthritis and muscle and joint pain. It has no psychoactive effect on the person, but it has high levels of THC, CBD, CBG, and some other components that really, really helps with pain. And so I think that the whole sleep and pain category is going to be a big one. And I think cannabis is going to play a role in that. And I think that's going to be biologicals rather than synthetics mm-hmm. because people really prefer today. The world is really moving towards much more homeopathic medicines than these awful drugs that people have hooked us on. And mm-hmm. so I think that'll be a big category. And Curaleaf wants to be a player there. And we have, I think, the largest R&D facility in the country working on products in that area. And the third is going to be your recreational market, which is very similar to, you know, mm-hmm. alcohol and other things. So the reason I made that statement was because I've been watching consumer behavior not only in the United States, but in the world. And people are really trying to move away from smoking. And it's not only because smoking, in the case of cigarettes, causes cancer, but it's because anything you put into your lungs that's not fresh air is not natural. And I think that the world is heading in a direction where we don't want to put anything into our lungs except oxygen. And I don't think this is going to happen soon, Ethan, because there's mm-hmm. a huge cannabis culture of smoking. But I think that culture is older, and I think the younger generation is going to move on to other products. Plus, as this industry and the products spread to new people, new customers, those people that never used cannabis, a lot of those people are not smokers. It's women replacing a glass of Chardonnay, or men for that matter, with, you know, a drink. And the drinks category, in terms of products, consumer-based products, is the biggest in the world. And edibles and drinking, that's the biggest. It's much bigger than anything to do with smoking. As a matter of fact, smoking is on the decline in the world, and drinks and edibles are on the increase. And so when I made the statement at the Benzinga conference in Chicago last week, so I said it's 5 to 10 years from now. I didn't say it's tomorrow, the next year. I said 5 to 10 years from now, I expect that the industry will be between 25 and 50%, drinks eventually going to 50%. And that's because it's a form of consumption that is really growing within the population, not only in the United States, but in the world, and smoking is falling off.
Does that mean that the importance of growing this very high-end marijuana in greenhouses with specific strains and all this is going to be less important? That when you're doing edibles and drinkables, it can really be outdoor grow? You don't need to be quite as particular in the content of these things?
So, you know, there is a storyline around that. I disagree with it because I think that the edibles and the drinks are much better with high-grade product. And you can taste the difference and feel the difference in the entourage effect by planting very good plants. Now, you know, my view generally, and I don't know how well the audience knows this, you know, I think this whole higher THC is better is garbage. I believe it's all in the terpenes. It's not in the THC. So, you know, I think an 18% THC plant and a 30% THC plant is going to give you the same effect depending on the profile of the terpenes. So I do think terpenes are absolutely critical. And for terpenes, you need very well-grown high-end cannabis. So I actually think you're going to still require really high-end and different strains to get different types of entourage effects from these plants.
Right. So now in terms of the broader future of the industry, I mean, you mentioned there about big pharma and how they're going to want synthetic cannabis, I guess, because you control dosing and purity and, you know, consistency more in that way. What about, you know, big tobacco? You know, I interviewed the chairman and former CEO of Philip Morris International, Andre Konzopoulos, a few months ago on Psychoactive. And he said, yeah, like, you know, there's been a couple of little investments. He kind of hedged on where they might go, but there's clearly evidence of them moving in. Do you see them ultimately dominating this? Or given what you're saying about people switching to edibles and to drinkables, do you see big alcohol or the big consumer good companies ultimately dominating this? Or will pure marijuana companies actually play their continuing major role? I mean, looking out 10, 15 years from now, what do you think?
So I think they're all going to be players in the sector. Mm-hmm. So I think the tobacco companies, in my opinion, will no longer be known as tobacco companies. They'll be known as cannabis companies. So I think there'll be prolific investors in the sector. As you know, the biggest investments made so far come from drinks tobacco companies. And I think that, you know, Philip Morris, no matter what he told you, I can tell you they are spending money and a lot of time. They are doing enormous amounts of R&D on the plant, on the cannabinoids, on the different entourage effects. They're going to be in the sector, no question. And I personally think they're going to get out of tobacco eventually and focus on cannabis and cannabis-related products.
I mean, it does seem like PMI is, you know, leading the way. I just heard a presentation by Vivian Azer, the analyst at Cowen, who follows the alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis industries. And PMI seems leagues ahead of all the other big ones in terms of making that transition. But one thing I do worry about, and this comes from the kind of public health part of my advocacy brain, is whether or not we're going to see the legal industry trying to fuse a nicotine product with cannabis. I mean, obviously, already people, you know, both in Europe and even the U.S., with their, you know, spliffs, blunts, whatever, they're already merging these two products. I remember when I lived in London for year, I didn't like it because all my friends would smoke them in combo and I didn't like the tobacco thing. But do you think that's going to happen, or you think governments are basically going to put prohibitions on selling those products in combination?
You probably remember this, right? Schumer said that he doesn't want the tobacco industry involved in the cannabis at all. And so I do think that there's going to be significant early pressure to keep the tobacco companies out. But I can tell you right now, British American Tobacco, Altria, Philip Morris, they're all writing big checks, particularly in Europe, not in the United States because of our federal prohibition, but in Europe, and investing in startup companies across the board.
But apart from the companies, what about the product itself? In other words, the notion of selling cannabis that also has nicotine in it.
You know, I've never smoked a cigarette. I think maybe one as a young kid. But I never liked cigarettes, and I didn't like the taste. I didn't like, I'm the wrong person to talk about cigarettes, except to tell you that I think there's going to be too much pressure on them to keep tobacco and particularly nicotine out of this space.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine. or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
So, Boris, you among, I think, all the major figures in the cannabis world in the U.S., at least, maybe not Canada, but the U.S., have been the most excited about the international markets and especially Europe. And everywhere I look, you're talking about Germany. You know, other major multi-state operators are not going to Europe in the same way, but you're big in Germany. And you pointed out that medical marijuana, you know, they didn't do that so well. But if they go for full legalization, it'll be big. And the new government says they're going to do it. So give us your perspective on Germany before I ask you about the rest of Europe.
First of all, Germany, you know, the way Germany goes, Europe tends to go. They're the leader, obviously, at least at the moment, especially now with the UK out of the European Union. I think the Germans are very, very focused. I mean, cannabis use, and by the way, psychedelic use is very prolific in Germany. You know, if you go to Berlin, you can't walk down the street without smelling cannabis everywhere. Same thing in Spain. But the German government is a rational government, right? They understand the taxation benefits. And so they are legalizing cannabis. It's our view that barring some treaty hiccups that they have, particularly on the EU side, I think the UN treaty is resolvable because Canada did it. And there's a precedent now for it. I think the EU treaty, nobody has addressed that issue.
What Canada did and what Germany might do is basically to do what Evo Morales, the former Bolivian president, did with coca, which is to withdraw from the treaty and then rejoin the treaty saying we don't agree to the coca provision, or in this case, the cannabis provision. That's what you're talking about?
Correct. And they get an exemption on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that no one's ever done that in the EU yet. At least we don't have a precedent. So this is groundbreaking. Now, obviously, see, if there's any country in the world that could do it in the EU, it's Germany, because the EU basically is Germany from an economic perspective. So I think they could lead the way, but they have to get people on their side. But Luxembourg is trying to get this. Switzerland is trying to get. So they have people. They have other countries that are on their side. I think there's five countries in all right now that are trying to get this through the EU.
I mean, it's weird how the Dutch, you know, who almost 50 years ago did the, you know, the coffee shop model with decriminalization, how they've just never kind of crossed over to making a fully legal backdoor, you know, the legal wholesale production of this stuff. It's very much the way that medical marijuana dispensaries were in the U.S., you know, between the time we first legalized medical marijuana in California in 96 until we got the first dispensary law in New Mexico in 07. I mean, basically, it was the thing where activists would start setting it up. First, the cops would shut them down. Then eventually, they say, well, maybe this works better this way. But it's weird how they've never gone all the way. Now, I also hear a lot of people talking about Portugal, but is that basically because of the cultivation side and their low-cost production?
Yeah, Portugal right now has a medical program, almost impossible. We've been an applicant for our products there for 3 years, and we're one of the biggest cultivators in the country, and we still haven't gotten our medical license. It takes forever. It's a very bureaucratic society. I think only one company, I think Tilray, has a license to sell. It's not a very big market because of the way they regulate it, but they are the center of cultivation because of the climate. The climate is very similar to California. And so you have the ability to grow basically three quarters of the year outdoors, sun grown or hoop houses or greenhouses. You can grow very, very nice product. And so that's why Portugal is so popular, because it has an absolutely perfect climate for growing cannabis. And most of the cannabis in Europe comes from Portugal today, rather than from any other country.
When given the factor of cost of production, why wouldn't a place like Colombia or Morocco or some other African country emerge as a major supplier in the way they have with coffee or tea or a whole range of other commodities, including psychoactive commodities?
So I think they will. I think Colombia is, you hit it on the nail on the head. Uganda is already supplying. Mm-hmm. There's Ugandan product coming into Germany right now. So, right. I mean, I do think they're going to be, but I think that, you know, some of these countries, some of these regions may put on limits. For instance, you know, up until last week, it was anticipated that all the cannabis coming into Germany would be EU GMP. Didn't matter where it come from. As long as it's EU GMP, you can import it into Germany for the REC program that's starting in 24. You know, there's rumors today that there's certain elements that have lobbied to say, we want to have domestic growing only. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that's nuts because Germany is probably the most expensive place in Europe to do business. And currently with the energy crisis, you couldn't grow a cannabis plant there, either in a greenhouse or indoors, that would be remotely profitable to sell. Or if you were selling, you'd sell it at such a price that it would be prohibitive for people to buy, and the black market would continue to proliferate. So I'm hoping the Germans walk away from that. And this is not cast in stone. This is just conversation. And we're going to hear this kind of conversation for the next 6 months as they go through rulemaking for the recreational program. Obviously, different interest groups in the country are going to be lobbying for different things. I personally think it's uneconomic to grow in Germany. And so I hope they walk away from that. But there is a rumor that they're going to try and do that.
And where do you see the greatest likelihood is of you know, countries in Central and Eastern Europe moving forward, leaving aside the Czech Republic, which has generally been more ahead of everybody in any case?
I think actually, interestingly enough, I know it's terrible, but Ukraine. So I actually have on my desk right now some due diligence on Ukrainian greenhouses. Zelensky has said that he wants to legalize cannabis in Ukraine. And so I think Ukraine could be come out, assuming we can get some resolution to this conflict.
You know, 20 years ago, the president of Kazakhstan, Nazarbayev, basically proposed that they look at the possibility of legalizing cannabis, not just hemp plant, but cannabis. And it didn't really go anywhere. But I mean, Kazakhstan has been the kind of hemp, you know, breadbasket, I guess, for that part of the world for a long time. Do you see any possibility that among the various stands and the former Soviet republics that apart from Ukraine, that Kazakhstan might begin to play a role?
So no, I don't think they're going to play a role. But I will tell you, there are two major Middle Eastern countries, major countries that are very high density populated countries that are considering medical first, and then eventually adult use.
Which, can you say which ones?
I think I don't want to jinx it because you know these are these are difficult issues for them, and I don't want to mess it up. But I've been advising them, and I can tell you that I think that very shortly you're going to hear about 80 million plus population country, which nobody would ever think would legalize. I think is going to legalize cannabis. Yeah. And a smaller secondary, but also very interesting country that is looking at adult use as a way to stimulate tourism in that country as well. So it's very interesting. Yeah. You know, I probably spend less time now, Ethan, on Curaleaf specific. I'm becoming a bit more of an ambassador, and I'm running around the world really trying to talk to these governments about opening up their countries to cannabis.
And Thailand. What a bizarre story there, this sudden legalization, these bizarre politics. You know, how's that all going to shake out? And are you looking there?
Yeah, we've had a team in Thailand probably for a month and a half. We're trying to be the first company to export from Europe into Thailand. So the transaction hasn't gone through yet, but, you know, these first transactions are always the most difficult. And after that, you know, the supply chain starts to work. But we are in the process of trying to get a fairly substantial first shipment into Thailand as a test case on supplying that country with European cannabis.
Okay, so to come full circle back to Russia here, I remember the early 2000s, you know, Putin comes to power with January 1st, 2000. In those early years, there was some kind of progressive stuff. There was a decriminalization, people being let out of prison. There was some support. The kind of, you know, crazy narcology establishment was kind of a little pushed back a bit. And I'm wondering, in Russia, in terms of cannabis, can you imagine a cannabis liberalization, or maybe liberalization is the wrong word, but medical cannabis and then maybe a broadening out happening in Russia in the next 5 to 10 years?
Listen, it's going to be difficult. For two reasons. Well, under Putin, I don't see it happening because he is anti-alcohol and anti-any drugs, right? The man is a health freak. He is never going to allow it, although I don't know where this study is now. He did allow one Russian government-owned organization to build a greenhouse and to plant cannabis as well as the opium plant, and to do medical research as to whether or not it actually works, because he had enough pressure on him with everything going on in the United States and Europe that he allowed for that to happen. And he said, if you guys can bring me medical evidence that these things actually cure or at least assist in medical conditions, and that this would be a cheaper variant to synthetic drugs, he said, I will seriously give it consideration. I think that was 3 years ago. But recreational, never under Putin's watch. He's adamantly against it. As a matter of fact, he apparently cracked a joke to someone once saying, ask some Russian that knew me, is Jordan still selling weed to the Americans? And that person said, yes. He goes, oh, thank God. So, you know, his view of cannabis is very negative, right? At least for his own population. However, you know, the population underneath Putin, and when that old guard steps away from power, is very different. Very different. I can tell you that the younger generation right underneath him is much more open-minded to these things. And so I would, if I was a betting man, and I'm in cannabis, so I guess I am, I would argue that Russia could move very quickly under a new regime. However, there are massive stigmas in Russia, very similar to the ones in the United States. Matter of fact, many people don't realize this, but if you take the political establishment class out, I see a tremendous amount of similarities between Russians and Americans. Tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. The way they think, the way they behave, a lot of things are very, very similar. And so the young generation in Russia is very progressive, very progressive. And I think that that generation, assuming it doesn't run off because of this war, I'm assuming that they would move on cannabis very quickly.
And finally, the last two mega markets out there, China. Is their role basically going to be on the hemp side and maybe the scientific side of synthetic cannabis? And that's it?
Yeah. They're not going to go recreational, I don't think.
Or even medical in any substantial way.
Yeah, I think they're very, very conservative. Although, you know, what's interesting about China is China's probably the center of holistic medicine. So it's kind of strange that they don't allow it. And you would think, given that their population uses roots and all sorts of things for medicine, and some of the greatest, you know, acupuncturists and stuff like that come out of China. I'm surprised, frankly, that they haven't adopted it. But the language out of China at the moment is negative.
And the country that may soon surpass China with the biggest population in the world, India, where many states have a long tradition of cannabis use and of drinking bong, the cannabis-infused beverage. Do you see India making any steps forward on this?
So if this country I'm talking about in the Middle East moves on cannabis over the next 3 months, which I expect that it will, I think that India could be next.
Very interesting. Well, Boris, this has been a fascinating conversation. So listen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and my listeners on Psychoactive. I think it's remarkable what you've done in building this mega company. It sounds like you're going to be in it for quite a while to come. I mean, I'm curious. I mean, do you see this as for the next 4 or 5 years of your life? Do you see ultimately selling Curaleaf to a bigger alcohol, tobacco, pharma, some other type of company, consumer goods company? I mean, what is the future, not just for Curaleaf, but I'm also asking you to speculate a bit about some of the other multi-state operators and major companies.
Ethan, one thing this is my fifth company I've built. And my formula has always never build a company to sell it. Build a company to compete and be best in class. And that's what I'm doing. In some cases, those companies got bought. In some cases, those companies stayed as independent operators. You know, I would love it if the landscape in the world was, you know, there's going to be obviously tobacco companies and alcohol companies and edible, you know, food companies. Everybody's going to use cannabis. I would like to think that there'll be one or two, you know, pure play cannabis consumer goods operators in the world. And that's what I'm trying to build. And I hope I'm successful. But, you know, I can't predict today what's going to happen. But I can tell you one thing. I'm not building Curaleaf to sell it to a tobacco company. I'm building Curaleaf to be competitive in this world.
There's one other thing I forgot to ask you about, which is one issue I've become passionate about since I stepped down from Drug Policy Alliance, is the whole fight over e-cigarettes and tobacco harm reduction. And the scientific evidence is pretty clear that if you could snap your fingers and all the smokers worldwide would suddenly stop and all take up vaping, and even if their number of vapers was greater than the number of smokers, and not just vaping, but the you know the lozenges, the things you put in your mouth, the oral versions, it would be one of the greatest advances in public health in human history. And you made the point before about you seeing a shift in cannabis consumption from the smoking and maybe even the vaping to things where you're not putting things in your lungs. And here we have a case where, you know, you see the shift from smoking to vaping. You see it's made a big difference, not just in places like Japan and Korea, but even in Russia and Ukraine. People stopping smoking, taking up these heat-not-burn nicotine tobacco stuff, the emergence of e-cigarettes in some places. You know, major advantage from a public health perspective. In some respects, in many parts of the world, even more controversial than cannabis is. But I'm curious, have you been keeping your eye on that area? Have you been following it, thinking about investing or the connections to cannabis?
I've been following it very closely. As a matter of fact, I've had numerous calls this week on the Juul situation that took place, you know, the settlement, the fine and everything. So I'm very much on top of the issue because I think it's very relevant. Listen, I think there's two things. The first thing is, you know, there's no question Juul targeted teenagers. And so in marketing and social media and everything they were doing. And so in that regard, and I saw the effects on children firsthand, I have five of them, of what vaping can do when you're trying to get your kid off of it. And I can tell you, it's a nasty look. I mean, hands shaking, they can't sleep, mood changes, really, really. So I do think that it's all about what you put in them. And my biggest question to vaping as a whole is there hasn't been enough work done on either the devices or on the effects of the vaping on the lungs of the individuals. So, and I know it, in some ways I'm talking against my own book because we sell a tremendous amount of vape pens. But there's heavy metals issues, right? A lot of people are putting all sorts of substances into these vapes. I mean, even edible biologicals have a different impact in your stomach versus your lungs. And I think that the issue is, we need more work done on that. I am sure, I'm absolutely sure that there is a way to make vaping safe. I'm absolutely sure of it. But I think that there needs to be more work and more transparency on the work that's already been done for the consumer to understand. So for instance, the company Select that I bought years ago, it was built on a very simple premise. It was a bunch of young guys out of Oregon that realized that the vape pens that people were using in California were making people cough hard and they were getting really bad coughs. And what happened was they were using silicon wicks in their vape pens and they were getting silicosis, and that was affecting their lungs and making them cough. And so these young guys did a simple thing. They went out and they replaced the silicon wick with a Japanese cotton wick, and all of a sudden the coughing stopped. But that's just one element, right? What about the, you know, the metals that are used?
No, Boris, I agree with you. But, you know, one sees now the FDA is basically green lighting a whole bunch of these things, you know, whether it's Enjoy or the, you know, Blue, I think it is. So they're definitely looking at this stuff. And even, you know, they blocked Juul and then got mud on their face because it seemed like they were doing it for political reasons, not for scientific reasons. So I'm glad you're keeping your eye on this area because I do think it's a fascinating one. And there's probably nothing that could more advance public health around the world than seeing a rapid transition from combustible cigarettes to the non-combustible forms of nicotine.
I completely agree with you. And this product that Philip Morris has in Europe, it's prolific, and it's illegal in the United States. It's amazing.
IQOS. You know, what is it called? You mean the IQOS?
Yeah, IQOS. Yeah,
IQOS. Well, it's caught up in litigation with another, I think, British American Tobacco or something, but I think eventually it's just going to get out there. And it's true. It's, and I think especially Russia and Ukraine are two of the biggest places where it's can, you know, be.
Oh, used. It's prolific, I can tell you. Even I was, you know, I was in Greece this this summer for a vacation. I mean, all the Europeans are using IQOS. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, Boris, on that note, thank you ever so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive. If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, I'll talk with Kurt Schmoke, a true profile in courage, the former Baltimore mayor who called for ending the war on drugs and putting all alternatives on the table.
The country and the national political scene was moving towards a crime bill that was going to be very, very harsh. So there was still basically a feeling that we can prosecute our way out of this problem, and it just needed, you know, more police resources, more incarceration, more for the DEA.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit Slack.com to get started.